Thoughts and Answers begins right now.
You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. For centuries, most people considered Sodom and Gomorrah's story a myth. In 2007, the world was stunned to hear that this notorious city had been discovered. Today on this episode of Evidence and Answers, Pat interviews Dr. Stephen Collins, the archaeologist who found the fabled city of Sodom. Listen in to the fascinating discoveries that were uncovered and the implications it has for us today. Now with part one of this two-part interview is our host, Pat.
All right. Well, Dr. Collins, one of the most significant discoveries, I think, is the city of Sodom. Because, you know, I came to Christ, you know, in high school, my senior year, and every book or commentary I picked up back there in the early 80s was saying this is a myth. The important thing is the lesson it teaches, you know, don't be bad, you know, treat people nicely, but otherwise it's really mythology. And you made a remarkable discovery here at Tal el Hammam there. Tell us a little bit about, first of all, how'd you select the site of Tal el Hammam? And when did you start digging there?
It was just one of those things that happens to you that you don't really know at the time where it's going to go or if it's going to go anywhere at all. I had, back in the 1990s, I had taken several tour groups, but one in particular, down to the southern part of the Dead Sea, where a site called Baba Draw was the traditional Sodom for a lot of people. And I took people down there. And the night before I did that on this one particular trip, I got the Bible out and was just kind of going to brush up on the Sodom story. So I read through it. And I got to the end of it and I thought, wait a minute, I don't see anything in that geography that would take us to the south end of the Dead Sea. And I read it again and again that same night, like four times. And I got to the end of all that and I thought, not only is there nothing in the text geographically to put Sodom at the south end of the Dead Sea, but everything in the text points it to the north and east of the Dead Sea. And so I was looking at that. And from that moment on, this was 1996, I think, and we were right in the middle of excavating the site of Ai up at Kerbin el-Makadr in the West Bank. Didn't need a project. I mean, we're just starting on that one. And so I thought, well, you know, if I ever run out of things to do, run out of projects, I'm going to come back to this, because it was bugging me sufficiently at that point where I needed to, I need to do something about that. So in the year 2000, we had a season in 2000 up at Kerbin el-Makadr, and it got, the Intifada got a little dicey. I mean, they're starting to throw rocks at the bus and things like that. It was not safe for us to excavate anymore up in the West Bank. And by that winter, I was thinking, no, wait a minute. What's an archaeologist going to do? We don't have a place to go. We need to be digging. And then I thought, Sodom. So I decided I was going to attack that issue while I had some time. So I did. And I put in a paper to read at the Near East Archaeological Society that fall. And so I knew if I didn't do that, by the way, I wouldn't do the research. I'd find an excuse. Something else would come along and snatch it from me. And so I'd say, okay, I'm gonna put in to read a paper. So I'll actually do it. And so I worked on it for a year. It got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. But I did present it that fall. And what was interesting about that, you mentioned Ed Yamauchi earlier. I remember when I got to the end of my presentation, because there were a bunch of people there. In fact, almost everybody in the room would have accepted Baba Draw in the South as Sodom. Yeah. They just would have. But there was one guy after I got through who was making his way up to me. I mean, he was just kind of going around people. I mean, that was Ed Yamauchi. He was coming from the back of the room and he's headed toward me. And I'm thinking, oh, Ed's going to clobber me. You know, he's going to bring something out of left field that I didn't see. And he came up and he said, I totally agree with you. Well, he said, that always bothered me. And I totally agree with you. And I felt real good. So if Ed thought that, then I feel better. But then one thing, push came to shove. But to shorten that whole story, it was the biblical geography, the very detailed geography of the location of Sodom embedded in Genesis 13. That was the primary passage that was written in Scripture to take us to the city of Sodom. And if you work through that geography, which I did very carefully, it took us north and east of the Dead Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially what scripture told us was that Sodom was the largest urban, fortified urban center northeast of the Dead Sea within the Kikar of the Jordan, the circular floodplain immediately north of the Dead Sea, where the Jordan River comes down and empties in to the north end of the Dead Sea. That's the Kikar of the Jordan. And so that's where Sodom would be located. So if it's the largest Bronze Age city in that area, how difficult would that be to find?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was difficult. Because
yeah.
when we got on the ground in Jordan and looked at all the sites, there was one site that was magnificently larger, several orders of magnitude larger than all the other sites in the region. In fact, we now know it as the largest continuously occupied Bronze Age city in the entire southern Levant. And so there's nothing bigger and longer lasting in the Bronze Age than the great city of Tal el Hammam, which, by the way, if you Google that up, you'll see it's Tal el Hammam, Sodom. Google's got it solidly labeled now as Sodom. And so the world view is changing on this, that the biblical description of Sodom demands a location north and east of the Dead Sea. And of course, then we excavated. So anyway, I always said it like this, Pat. It should be in the right place. It's got to be in the right place. Genesis 13 geography, the right time frame. That's time frame of Abraham. And it's got to have all the right stuff. And part of the right stuff was, how was Sodom destroyed? Genesis 19 says Sodom was destroyed by fire and burning stone, or burning stone and fire. Translated sulfur sometimes, or you know, brimstone. That's just one of the many meanings of this. Several times in the Old Testament, Goprit is translated lightning. But really, the base meaning is like burning stone. So burning stone and fire from out of the heavens. What does that sound like? It sounds like meteoritic activity to me.
Uh-huh.
It sounds like an asteroid strike or a comet frag or something like that. And lo and behold, now at the end of our excavations, the last 5 or 6 years, a whole team of impact researchers, astrophysicists, geophysicists, a material scientist, a whole big team of them, over 20 of them, began analyzing and studying samples from the Middle Bronze Destruction Layer. That's the time of Abraham, Middle Bronze Age. From the Middle Bronze Destruction Layer at Tal Hammam. And what have they proved? Now, two big scientific papers have been published. One in 2021 in Nature Scientific Reports, a very prestigious journal. And another one about less than a month ago now, the follow-on paper has been published. And they are ranking way up there. Some of the highest accessed scientific papers in the history of scientific papers. It's really amazing the readership we've gotten off this. But right stuff, a destruction by a meteoritic cosmic event. And that's exactly what the Bible describes. So anyway, here's what we've got now. Tal Hammam's in the right place. It's in the right time frame. It has the right destruction to be the city of Sodom. It has everything you need to be the city of Sodom. It's just a given now. By the way, the southern site that everybody wants to make out to be Sodom was destroyed at least 500, if not 700 years before Abraham was ever born. I don't care where you date Abraham, early or late.
Uh-huh.
Baba Dra was destroyed about 2500 BC. That's way too early for the time of Abraham. Everybody knows it, but they don't like to think about it sometimes.
Yeah.
So Tal Hammam is the right place. In fact, what was really exciting and a little bit weird last year, my wife and I like the show Jeopardy. You ever watch Jeopardy?
Mm-hmm.
And we're watching Jeopardy, and lo and behold, we get to Final Jeopardy. And what's the question on Final Jeopardy? A site in Northern Jordan. I mentioned our site. Tal Hammam has been identified, destroyed by an airburst, blah, blah, blah. What biblical city do they think this is? You know, and of course, there we are. We even made Final Jeopardy. And by the way, only one of the three contestants got it right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, hey, tell us what you found at that destruction site. I mean, the destruction level. How far down did you have to go? I don't think people understand the layers you had to work through. And what did you find at that destruction site that convinces you this thing was destroyed? It was not burned down. Something else happened there.
Well, over about 80% of the site the destruction layer from the Middle Bronze Age, from the time of Abraham, is right on the surface. On the upper city, it's below about 3 or 4 meters, 10 feet or so of Iron Age debris, because during the time of King David and Solomon, they built a store city up on top, and because it took about 700 years for the grain to start to be able to grow there in that area again. Mm-hmm. But anyway, from the time that that city was destroyed, it took over 700 years for the soils in the area to recuperate to the point where they could grow grain once again. So this was a big devastation. Just wasn't a city. It was 400 square kilometers of a civilization there that was destroyed in the blink of an eye. But what we discovered, and by the way, when we say we discovered it in the Middle Bronze destruction layer, time of Abraham, and not in the strata above, this would be the upper city, because on the lower city, there's no stratum above it. There's only strata below it. Mm-hmm. And because nobody ever built on the lower city over it. So this destruction layer across the entire site, upper city, lower city, wherever we excavate, is a meter to a meter and a half deep.
Mm-hmm.
It's thick debris. Yeah. In that debris, everything is churned up. Pieces of bricks, pieces of plaster, pieces of animals, pottery, and pieces of people. We called it one of our supervisors called it the Cuisinart effect. It's like somebody took a city, threw it in a blender, and hit the button. That's what that destruction matrix looks like. It just churned up. But it's full of what we call airburst proxies. These are the kinds of things that are created by one of these explosive, catastrophic meteoritic airburst events that are only created by this kind of event, impact event. And we're talking about elements like high platinum spike, iridium, osmium, fractured quartz. By the way, fractured quartz grains are something really interesting because quartz fractures at a very, very high pressure rate. Now, you know what the pressure of your car tires are, right? 30, 33 PSI. To create shocked quartz, that's to take a quartz grain and fracture it in the way that the quartz grains in this layer are, many of them are fractured. It's now estimated, and this is part of these scientific papers that have been written, it takes 750,000 pounds per square inch to create the fractured quartz that they're finding on the site. That's pressure.
Wow.
We have pieces of pottery, the surfaces of which are melted superficially into a greenish glass. And underneath that melt, that surface melt, they have found, for example, zirconia, the mineral zirconia, crystals of zirconia that were not only melted, in other words, they weren't angular. When you put them under an electron microscope, a big scanning electron microscope, they should be normal, angular, but they're not. They're like bubbles. They're melted. What does it take to melt a zircon? About 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit. What does it take to boil zircon? We actually found zircons with little bubbles in them, they're starting to off-gas, they're starting to boil. And what's it take to boil a zircon? Almost 8,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So we're talking about temperatures that are just, whoa. By the way, by comparison, flowing volcanic magma is about 1,800 to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit. The hottest temperatures that are able to be created terrestrially by natural means are cool compared to the temperatures and the temperature indicators of high heat on Tal el-Hamam. We're talking about thousands of degrees, not just a couple thousand degrees.
Yeah.
So the indicators are across the entire site. They are churned into the layers, but they're not rare. In fact, we found the first high heat indicator melted pottery sherd we found on the site happened in the first little 2x2 meter probe that we did into the Middle Bronze destruction matrix. Remember, there are 13,000 6x6 meter squares across this vast site. In the very first penetration we made into the Middle Bronze destruction layer, we began to find these high heat melt products. What does that tell you? We didn't hit a needle in a haystack. We hit a fairly common phenomenon, and that was that all kinds of materials, mud bricks, we found melted bricks, plasters, not just pottery. So And of course, they had to be in exactly the right place, like on the roof, exactly the maximal exposure, because this explosive event happens like that.
Yeah.
It happens in a fraction of a second. So everything is going to be sheared off, pulverized, destroyed. And we find, by the way, silica microspherules, little tiny, that can't even see them with the naked eye, this tiny spherules of iron and silica and other things. These are the kinds of things that happen with airburst events. So in the Tal Hammam destruction layer, we have now over 20, I think the count is, the first paper it was 21, now it's up to over 25 proxies, specific phenomena that only occur with airburst impact events are found in the destruction layer at Tal Hammam. There's no doubt now that Tal Hammam, Sodom, was destroyed by a fiery cataclysm that came out of the heavens. There's no doubt about that. That's a scientific fact.
Yeah, wow. And what about Lot's wife here? Did you find the pillar of salt there? Did you find her?
Well, you know, if you had asked me that question maybe 10 or 15 years ago, even while we were excavating, I didn't have a really good answer to that question. I, of course, I'd thought about it, because every time you talk to somebody about it, they ask you the question, what about Lot's wife? And I didn't know. I don't know. We were looking at everything. I mean, we even found an Arabic idiom from like the Middle Ages, that the word pillar of salt, phrase pillar of salt, was a reference to some kind of cancer. I mean, we were all over the map and trying to see what in the world this language actually meant. But what's interesting is we now know that this airburst, this explosive airburst event, where you have a meteoritic object coming in at a very shallow angle and coming through the atmosphere, it's going to go from solid to liquid to gas to plasma in a very short period of time, in a matter of less than a second. And when that happens, it's a huge explosion. The temperatures are off the charts. They're like nuclear explosion kind of temperatures. And by the way, we're not saying this is a bomb, right? It's not ancient aliens or anything like that. But what we are saying is that this explosive kind of event creates an event that has certain proxies, these little results that can only happen with these events. And we've got a bunch of those. And what happened, one of those proxies, and I didn't mention this one of those proxies in that destruction layer is a high level of Dead Sea salt.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that it came in shallow, exploded, went to critical mass over the north end of the Dead Sea. It's the only way to explain the salt. And so when that thing exploded, and as it's coming in, it pushed vast quantities of vaporized Dead Sea water and vaporized salt up over the landscape, which became part of the permanent matrix of the destruction at Tal Hammam. In the destruction layer of the time of Abraham at Tal Hammam, there is a 6 times more concentration of Dead Sea salt than there is in the Dead Sea water. How did that get so salty? Well, it got salty probably because of this event that just pushed this up over the landscape and just seeded the landscape with all of this vaporized salt. What's interesting about that is if Lot's wife had gone south towards Zoar, which she did, the Bible tells us, she had headed south towards Zoar, which is down toward the southern end of the Dead Sea, or about actually around the Wadi Mujib, which is maybe about a half a day, 3/4 of a day ride on a donkey. She stopped and turned back. We don't know if she's walking back or she just turned back and looked. But obviously she stopped on the margin of the blast zone. Had she been in the blast zone, she'd have been vaporized. But she was evidently far enough on the margin where what happens is that as that salt was pushed up over the landscape, the whole landscape, including her, was covered with salt. And it instantly, of course, hardened as a crust over the whole landscape, including her. Well, obviously, she was covered with it and it just encrusted her. She didn't even have time to fall down because it was enough heat where the water just vaporized out. And this salt just went from being vaporized to being solid again in a very quick kind of interval. That we think that's what happened to her. She became a pillar of salt. Now, we all know that Dead Sea salt is highly water soluble. So in a few rainy seasons, she would have melted away.
Oh, yeah.
So when somebody takes you to the Holy Land, they say, oh, see that little spire up there? That's Lot's spire.
Yeah.
Don't believe it, because there's lots of them. In fact, there's one that has several spires. It's like Lot and his daughter and his dog. You know,
it's like, you know. Yeah. That's an incredible find. I mean, what is this? I mean, what is the significance of this discovery? Is it? I think it's a game changer here because, you know, I even now you pick up so many commentaries on the Pentateuch, and you know they say, well, a lot of this is non-historical, or it's written the Wellhausen theory. You know what you mentioned, JEPD, written by a group of priests, maybe in the 6th or 7th century, kind of thing. But a discovery like this, you know, account that pretty much, I'd say, I rarely found a book that would acknowledge this as historical. Is this discovery a game changer here?
I think it certainly is. It's the biggest, most important discovery relative to the historicity of the Old Testament, I think, ever. Because here, you know, what's the most doubted book in the Old Testament? Book of Genesis. Yeah,
Genesis.
Most criticized, most doubted. Mm-hmm. And this is probably one of the most doubted stories, right? This is crazy. Oh, you know, this doesn't happen. You know, great fiery cataclysm comes out of the sky and consumes a whole civilization. No, this kind of thing doesn't happen. Well, guess what? With Tall Hammam, by the way, it's not just Tall Hammam. It has a whole bunch of cities around it.
Yeah.
Just as the Bible describes. And so they're all in the right place in the right time, the right stuff and the right destruction. Everything is exactly as the Bible describes it. Now, what do you do with that? This, you really only have two choices. It's either completely a coincidence, totally accidental, or what we're finding is descriptive of the physical evidence left behind by the biblical story of Sodom. Those are the only two choices. Now, since we have the goods, and I'm talking about the evidence, the archaeology, the astrophysics, everything that goes with it, all of that exists. That's not going away. So you can either choose to believe that there is a foundational, historical, foundational story of a real meteoritic airburst event in the time of Abraham that destroyed an entire civilization of Sodom and Gomorrah, and you can accept that somehow it found its way into the Bible, or ignore it. There are people who will ignore it. Mm-hmm. They don't want to deal with it because they know what it means. If I accept the historicity of this, do I then have to accept the historicity of the characters in the story?
Mm-hmm.
Where do I go from there? If this much is historical and not mythical, which it now is known not to be, this is historical stuff, what do we do with the rest of it?
Yeah.
They don't want to go there. They don't want to go there. So logic and reason would force them to start talking in terms of the actual historicity of the book of Genesis, and then of the Torah and the Exodus and the conquest and on through the rest of the Bible. The logic of it would force them to quit shaking their head when it comes to the Bible and start nodding, okay, yeah, this stuff really did happen. I think when it comes to still, in the face of evidence, still rejecting the historicity of the Bible, this is a personal moral choice. This is not an intellectual, evidential choice. It's not a scientific choice.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586. Or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.